Blood tests reveal DEQ employees in Helena were not at risk of overexposure to lead. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll tell you about changes in Montana's deer hunting season for the next 2 years. And in tonight's feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with Montana conservationist Jim Posowitz about the effort to create a Montana Outdoor Hall of Fame. Blood tests done on 97 state employees who had worked in the former National Guard Armory in Helena indicated they were not at risk of overexposure to lead. The State Department of Environmental Quality closed the building on October 28th after finding lead levels up to 40 times higher than federal standards in ceilings throughout the building. Follow-up air tests revealed acceptable lead levels. The State Department of Administration has blood test results from 97 people, and only two indicated slightly elevated lead levels. Dr. Michael Cosnett of the University of Colorado School of Medicine concluded that current and former employees are not at risk of overexposure. The Independent Record reports not all state employees who have worked at the Armory have been notified about the testing.
And in other news from around the state, the body of a missing Hamilton woman was found behind a grocery store yesterday. Hamilton Police Chief Ryan Oster says the 61-year-old woman appears to have died of exposure. Her body was taken to the state crime lab in Missoula for an autopsy. Oster says the woman was evicted from her apartment on February 7th, and she was reported missing on February 11th. A man who had been walking in the area behind the store found the woman's body near some bushes. The woman's name was being withheld until family members could be notified.
A Canadian man died in a weekend skiing accident at Whitefish Mountain Resort in northwestern Montana. The Flathead County Sheriff's Office says 48-year-old Thomas Podovinsky of Calgary, Alberta, died after falling into a tree well. Officials say Podovinsky was skiing with a friend when they became separated about 12:30 yesterday afternoon. When he failed to meet up with a group of people as planned, he was reported missing at about 1 p.m. Ski patrollers found Podovinsky upside down in a tree well and were unable to resuscitate him. A tree well is a hole in the snow that forms around the base of a tree. Podovinsky is the second man to die in a tree well at the resort this year. A 53-year-old California man died on January 11th.
Five people were caught in weekend avalanches in the mountains of western Montana, and one woman suffered a broken leg. The Gallatin County Sheriff's Office says a 35-year-old woman suffered a broken leg yesterday when she was caught in an avalanche near Big Sky in southwestern Montana. The woman was with a group of backcountry skiers who triggered the slide. She was carried down the mountain and ended up partially buried and pinned against a tree. On Saturday, a snowmobiler triggered an avalanche near Whitefish Mountain Resort that partially buried four people. The Flathead Avalanche Center says all four made it out of the area safely. The slide was about 900 feet wide and ran 700 feet downhill. Debris at the base was about 6 feet deep.
At least 10 times since 2008, freight trains hauling oil across North America have derailed and spilled significant quantities of crude. Most of the accidents have touched off fires or catastrophic explosions. The derailments released a total of almost 3 million gallons of oil, and the deadliest wreck killed 47 people in Quebec. Those findings are from an Associated Press review of U.S. and Canadian accident records. They underscore a lesser-known danger of America's oil boom, which is changing the global energy balance but raising urgent safety questions closer to home. Adding to the danger is the unusually high volatility of the light sweet crude from the fast-growing Bakken oil patch in Montana and North Dakota, where many of the oil hauling trains originate.
The U.S. House candidate in Montana is benefiting from a political action committee he created, leading at least one opponent and some experts to question the legality of the arrangement. Ryan Zinke is a 52-year-old former Navy SEAL who is seeking the Republican nomination for Montana's lone congressional seat. He created the Special Operations for America Super PAC to back Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign. Zinke resigned from the PAC in September and announced his candidacy weeks later. Since then, SOFA PAC has spent more than $70,000 on television, radio, and internet advertising in support of Zinke's campaign. Zinke says he had an attorney review the PAC's leadership transition to ensure there was no conflict of interest or violation of any Federal Election Commission rules on campaign coordination.
Officials in Flathead County have released the name of a 71-year-old Hungry Horse man who was shot to death on Valentine's Day. Sheriff Chuck Curry tells the Flathead Beacon that Thomas Eugene Edwards died of a single gunshot wound to his chest. Deputies responded to a shooting report at about 8 p.m. Saturday night. Edwards' girlfriend, 55-year-old Pamela Ruth Haynes, was arrested and jailed on suspicion of deliberate homicide.
The Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks is scaling back the state's deer hunting season for the next 2 years. The State Fish and Wildlife Commission voted last week to not issue mule deer bee hunting tags, otherwise known as antlerless tags. That means mule deer hunting in the state will be buck only unless wildlife officials determine there is a need in specific hunting districts. Bee tags for white-tailed deer will also be removed in much of central and northeastern Montana. FWP spokesman Ron Osheim describes it as a major shift for the hunting season, as the state normally issues hundreds or thousands of bee tags. But Osheim says both deer species have been having population problems.
Both species, mule deer, have been on a trend downward, and they're cyclical. We know that. And there's some conditions we don't probably know about that precipitate that. They have been down. Looks like maybe in some places they're starting to recover. That's a region-wide thing. And whitetail, just very simply, Dan, we had that horrible winter in 10 and 11 and then had a real significant disease outbreak this last year in a big part of the state and lost lots and lots of whitetail.
Osheim says the whitetail populations are expected to rebound faster than the mule deer. This year's general deer hunting season begins October 25th.
The Montana Migrant and Seasonal Farmworker Council has opened a year-round health clinic north of Lolo. Strategic planning specialist Claudia Stevens tells the Ravalli Republic there's a need for the clinic to serve agricultural workers. She says Ravalli County has one of the highest percentages of agricultural workers in the state. The nonprofit clinic opened in January and is staffed by a clinical director, two outreach workers, and two family nurse practitioners. The clinic provides primary and preventive care, wellness exams, health screening, obstetrics and gynecology care, and testing for sexually transmitted diseases. A dental hygienist is also available once a week.
The Helena City Commission is moving forward with ways to better regulate residential parking districts, including with increased enforcement. The Independent Record reports the commission is looking at creating clearer regulations for granting requests to protect curbside parking. Officials say neighborhood parking can be monopolized by students and weekday workers. Officials say the city has 14 parking districts. Helena Parking Commission Director Dave Hewitt says income from permits associated with the districts doesn't cover the cost of patrolling and enforcing the districts. Permits cost $20. Hewitt says not many people are buying permits for the districts. He also says notices are being left at homes and on vehicles, alerting residents that increased enforcement of parking districts is coming. Officials are also looking at new fees.
Officials in Butte-Silver Bow County say they plan to start sending notices to owners of 229 houses or other buildings the county says need immediate repairs. Historic Preservation Officer Jim Jarvis tells the Montana Standard the decision follows a six-month project to identify properties that are posing a nuisance to the public. Jarvis's past experience tells him about half of the owners will fix the properties, some will sell them, and about 50 will ignore notices. Jarvis says legal proceedings will be started against the holdouts. Officials say many of the properties are years behind in property taxes, and the county doesn't want to end up with them by default.
A Billings man has been sentenced to 30 years in prison for a felony DUI that happened just weeks after he was released from prison on an earlier DUI conviction. The Billings Gazette reports District Judge Gregory Todd sentenced 55-year-old John Harvey Hoots on Friday. Deputy Yellowstone County Attorney Julie Patton says Hoots has been convicted of driving under the influence at least 10 times. Hoots was arrested in July 2012, about 6 weeks after being released from a 10-year prison sentence. According to trial testimony, a neighbor called 911 to report Hoots had dropped his pants and exposed himself. Hoots drove away as officers responded. A blood sample showed Hoots' blood alcohol level was 0.20. Hoots testified he fled because his neighbor threatened to shoot him. His neighbor denied the threat.
A group of Montana state agencies and conservation organizations are working to create a Montana Outdoor Hall of Fame. Well-known Montana conservationist and founder of Orion, the Hunters Institute, Jim Posowitz, is behind the effort to honor people who've contributed to the restoration and conservation of Montana's fish, wildlife, and other outdoor amenities. In tonight's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Posowitz has more and explains his lifelong passion for the outdoors.
My first 18 years of life were spent growing up in Wisconsin. And I happened to be growing up in a place that at that time, in the second half of the 30s, 40s, and a year or two in the 50s, that was totally depleted of wildlife opportunity. And came to Montana in 1953 because I simply had an attraction to nature, which led to wanting to hunt and to fish and to trap. And that led me to Montana State in 1953. I got a couple degrees in fish and wildlife management, a little military time in between, and then, you know, sort of my primary career with fish, wildlife, and parks. So I've kind of been addicted to the outdoors since birth. None of it had anything to do with, say, family traditions.
What is it about the outdoors, whether it's hunting or just being out there and enjoying the peace? What is it that's the draw, the rush for you?
Well, it's hard to define. It starts with a natural curiosity and leads to a genuine interest and ultimately becomes a passion.
Tell us about the genesis of this Montana Outdoor Hall of Fame. Its purpose aside for just a moment, where did this idea come from?
In October 13th, 2012, I was invited to give a banquet speech at the 7th induction of the Wyoming Outdoor Hall of Fame. It was in Cody, Wyoming, and so I went down to Cody to give a banquet speech for their induction ceremony, and I looked at their material, and then I thought, holy mackerel, in Montana, we've got some exceptional people in our history and in our contemporary advocacy for the outdoor amenities that we really should do something similar here. And in Cody, I gave the banquet speech on the 13th of October, 2012. And in its preparation, I realized or noticed and then incorporated it into my presentation that that day was one day short of the 100th anniversary of Theodore Roosevelt taking a bullet during the Bull Moose campaign, an assassination attempt. And he was in that campaign to protect the reforms that he had instituted during his presidency. And it didn't kill him. In fact, it didn't even interrupt his schedule. It lodged a quarter inch from his heart, and he went and gave a speech on progressive politics as part of the 1912 Bull Moose campaign. And I thought, there is so many fascinating stories and people involved in the restoration of wildlife to North America, and that this Hall of Fame idea that I basically borrowed from Wyoming would be a way of recognizing those people and teaching their stories.
And this Hall of Fame, would it be a physical building like the Baseball Hall of Fame or the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or what?
Well, it's going to start out, as a collection of information and stories initially stored with modern technology we have, the Montana Historical Society and other places. We envision sort of a mobile exhibit that we could take to the annual events or meetings of groups that were interested and just start telling that story over and over again and surfacing through communications, with Montana people, individuals that deserve recognition and deserve to have their stories told.
Do you have any examples? I realize the official nominations, that's a ways off, but what sort of stories?
Let me give you an example. Granville Stewart comes into Montana in 1857, and he's a miner, a rancher, a farmer, a merchant. He does all these things, that civic leaders would do during pioneering years. He leads the vigilantes eventually. But in addition to that high-profile kind of activity, He does his best, he and his brother James, to start protecting Montana wildlife. The first thing he talks about when he rides over Moneta Pass in 1857 was the abundance of wildlife and the condition of the land. In 1864, his brother James and he are both in the Montana Territorial Legislature. They pass a bill to restrict taking of fish to a hook and line, because they were seining them and otherwise, you know, getting them out of the creek any method they could. The pioneers and ranchers are miners at that era. That legislation passed the Montana Territorial Legislature in 1864. That was 12 years before Custer dies at the Little Bighorn. Now, that is a deep conservation ethic root that I think is worthy of taking note of. In 1872, Granville puts through a bill trying to stop the slaughter of buffalo and other wildlife. They don't have a conservation infrastructure in those years. And so in that period, we turned Montana into the boneyard of a continent. An example of that would be writings of Theodore Roosevelt, who has his conservation epiphany basically on the Montana-North Dakota border area. But he wrote of a ranchman who made a journey looking for open-range grazing opportunity from basically the Montana-North Dakota border to along the Milk River. And it was described as a journey of 1,000 miles. So if you go 500 miles out and 500 miles back up the Milk River, you probably come within sight of Glacier Park from roughly Medora, North Dakota. And then Roosevelt wrote, to use the ranchman's own words, I was never out of sight of a dead buffalo and never in sight of a live one in a journey of 1,000 miles. And today, you know, we have deer in our cities, bears in our orchards, and goose dung on every golf shoe in Montana. That was not an accident. And this program or this idea seeks to collect, recognize, and then tell the stories of the people who made contributions at every level in Montana culture, whether it's the arts or the sciences or, you know, land use.
So then it's designed to both, or is it either or, honor the past or educate for the future?
Both of those things. Yeah. And, of course, the way you do that is to find a way to catch the public's attention and in that process do a little education and storytelling. You know, for the most part, when you study the history of a place, it's always presented as to how we exploited that place. You know, first came the fur trade, then came the miners, then came the agrarians. And yet, if you walk up to a Montana person and said, describe Montana to me, they would invariably start with the wild places we nurtured and preserved and restored.
And as you well know, Mr. Posowitz, one person's nurtured resource may well be another's terrible idea. Take the wolf, for example. How do you and your colleagues go about appeasing everybody with a project like this, or can you?
Well, you know, the only guy that would maybe appease all interest groups wound up getting crucified. So that's not our objective. Our objective is to simply tell the truth of our history and to point out that these amenities we so cherish today did not get to our generation by accident. They got to our generation by people, both professional and volunteer, doing good things, sometimes on a mega scale and sometimes on just a very small local scale. But it was a conservation ethic that is carried in the Montana culture. And it starts with when Granville Stewart rode in here in 1857.
How much would a Montana Outdoor Hall of Fame cost, and how will it be funded?
Well, we currently have a challenge grant from the Cinnabar Foundation to collect enough money to make it happen. We're doing it for the first time, so it's hard to give you a cost example, but everybody working on it now is working on it in a volunteer basis. We have this small planning committee combining state agencies who are contributing, you know, taking on this project in addition to their regular work, seeing the value in it. And then we are also recruited a handful of non-government organizations that are in the conservation field so that this doesn't just become sort of a government project. We have a memorandum of understanding that all the parties participating have signed. And we have a challenge grant from the Cinnabar Foundation of $10,000. We're trying to match that now. It'll be a combination of, you know, funds we can raise and contributed services.
What's the timeline here?
The timeline is to have our inaugural event on December 6th of 2014. And I think it kind of fits a conservation theme and a Montana theme in that 2014 is the 150th anniversary of Montana Territory Declaration. Montana became a territory 150 years ago, and the Wilderness Act was passed 50 years ago. So we have a couple of events that are occurring anniversaries that are worth lining up with.
And if somebody is listening and would like to find out more, what's the best way to go about doing that?
The best way to go about doing that is, I guess, listen to public radio.
We like that.
And we're going to, you know, start putting out the periodic news releases and things of that nature. Then we'll send out notices. We'll build a mailing list of conservation organizations and individuals who we think might have an interest in this. And we'll have our first sort of inaugural event and then the induction of our first group of honorees on the 6th of December 2014, which is the target date. You know, that's a ways off. We do not want to change that, but, you know, we're still doing this for the first time.
Yeah. And it should be mentioned that you're working for some tribal representation as well, yeah?
Yes, that's right. They gave us what we tend to call pristine Montana. And I think there are members of that part of our culture that continue to contribute to conservation and restoration of what was lost in the process of settling this place.
I've been speaking with Jim Posowitz, known for so many things in Montana, but for today's purposes, the Montana Outdoor Hall of Fame. Mr. Posowitz, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for chatting with us.
Well, thank you for calling.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 11 p.m. this evening for West Glacier region, the Bitterroot Sapphire Mountains, the Butte Blackfoot region, and the Potomac Sealy Lake region. Tonight, there are areas of rain and snow, which are likely with lows in the 20s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and snow and highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s. For central Montana, there is a winter weather advisory in effect until 11 p.m. this evening for elevations above 4,500 feet for the Rocky Mountain front. Tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies and a chance of rain and snow in the evening. Lows 25 to 30 degrees with west wind gusts up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be partly cloudy with highs 40 to 45 degrees and west wind gusts up to 35 miles per hour. For southwest Montana, tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and lows 15 to 25 degrees and west wind gusts up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow should have increasing clouds and highs 35 to 45 degrees.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 47 degrees with partly cloudy conditions. In Kalispell, it's mostly cloudy with 38 degrees. Butte has 38 degrees under partly cloudy skies. Great Falls is sunny and windy with 42 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under raining skies is 37 degrees. It's 40 degrees and partly cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's raining and 39 degrees. Libby has 35 degrees with light rain. And in Polson, it's raining and it's 39 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Bruce Farling.
When the Montana Supreme Court ruled strongly last month in favor of the public being able to legally access the Ruby River for recreational uses at County Bridge rights-of-ways, it generated predictions of doom from the usual suspects who have long defended the concept of keeping the public out of public waters. Debbie Barrett, the Republican state senator from Dillon, claimed in recent op-eds that the ruling brazenly seizes private property without just compensation. She says it will create untold headaches for landowners, conjuring mobs of unruly pitchfork-wielding anglers, torching Riverside McMansions owned by cowering, defenseless hedge fund managers. Bozeman's Property and Environment Research Center, or PERC, also predictably weighed in with op-eds condemning the high court. This self-styled $3 million a year so-called nonprofit think tank has long pushed for privatizing public resources. It has been very vocal in defending the losing side in other court cases in which absentee streamside landowners unsuccessfully sought to kick the public off Montana's rivers and streams. Precisely who funds PERC is largely a mystery, but a little web research indicates few surprises. Many of the center's donors apparently are foundations with connections to corporations or families such as the Kochs, Mellons, and Scaifes, who also fund industry front organizations that fight environmental regulation of oil and gas development or who generate propaganda denying that humans have a role in climate change. Non-Montana business executives and academics dominate PERC's board. We're not talking here about an organization that generally prioritizes the interests of workaday Montanans. The recent Supreme Court decision merely affirmed that Montanans have a legal right to use public easements at public bridges to enter rivers for recreation. In doing so, it rejected the claims of James Cox Kennedy, the Atlanta media mogul, who owns a ranch along the Ruby River near Sheridan and who has long desired to prevent anglers from wading the reach of river bordered by his ranch. Kennedy is so determined to keep the public off the Ruby River that he also sought to have Montana stream access law declared an unconstitutional taking of private property. This bedrock law allows the public to wade or float in any stream capable of supporting recreation, irrespective of navigability tests or who owns the bed and banks. But he got zero traction on his arguments. The court noted the access law has already been deemed constitutional, and besides, how could his property be taken when he bought it after the access law was in place? Annoyed that supporter Kennedy was denied, PERC also recently criticized the court on op-ed pages, citing previously rejected constitutional arguments. But as usual, PERC went farther. It also repeated a past argument that goes like this. Unless people like Kennedy can keep the public off streams that are adjacent to or run through their property, river stewardship and trout fisheries will deteriorate, and all Montanans will subsequently then suffer. That's because when the unwashed recreate on these streams, landowners get mad. And when mad, they won't protect or restore habitat, resulting in fewer fish and recreational benefits off-site. Therefore, Kennedy and his ilk supposedly do us a favor by preventing public access to public resources. This self-centered and silly view ignores a few key points. First, the vast majority of Montana streamside landowners are quite willing to protect and restore habitat, without demanding in turn that the public be prohibited from using nearby streams. Trout Unlimited and state agencies have worked with hundreds of landowners in recent years, most who are not wealthy, to restore habitat and improve fisheries. None demand exclusive use in return. That's because they are not motivated by self-interest. Instead, they care about the land and their fellow Montanans. PERC also forgets that most, if not all, landowners it purports to speak for, including Kennedy and some Bitterroot Valley absentee landowners who have long fought public access, including a Nevada casino developer and the founder of the nation's leading discount stock brokerage, bought riverside property in Montana precisely because of the existing high quality of the river and fishing. And these attractions resulted from ordinary Montanans fighting for decades to protect habitat, wild fish, and undeveloped headwaters, or they were produced by everyday anglers working with caring landowners to restore habitat and stream flows. It seems, then, that the interest PERC represents actually owe regular Montanans rather than the other way around. But I wouldn't count on these folks getting any of this anytime soon. This is Bruce Farling of Montana Trout Unlimited. Contact us at www.montanatu.org.
Bruce Farling is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.